The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, everybody, we've got a special doubleheader episode for you today on the Lincoln Project Podcast. First, we have an interview we recorded a couple weeks ago with Greg Sargent, and we kept thinking, today's the day. But today is the day, and I'll tell you why. It's about Stephen Miller and ICE, and it's a really important topic because Stephen Miller is in control of the horrors that we are seeing play out on the streets of America and in control of the public executions of American citizens. We also have an interview with what DHS should be doing. It's with former FEMA director Craig Fugate. The whole country is locked in this massive ice storm. We've got another big ice storm coming next weekend. Millions of Americans are trapped in their homes or without power right now. And so talking to somebody who really understands disasters and understands what FEMA should be doing instead of being cut back to pay for these guys in the streets is really enlightening. And Fugate's a very smart guy, very good guy. But anyway, this is a doubleheader. One more thing before we go. Folks, the congressional resolution, or the continuing resolution on the ICE funding is coming up. It is important that Chuck Schumer not just say he won't vote for it. He needs to whip his caucus against it. We're going to throw the number up for Congress. Please call Congress, call your senators, and call Chuck Schumer and tell him that he needs to whip his caucus against the DHS bill, not just say he's not going to vote for it. That's a cheat. So put the number up on the screen. We'll leave it there. We'll also throw it up during the show. But do give them a call. Thanks so much. We'll see you again next time.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night, and good luck.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. As always, I am your host, Rick Wilson. I want to thank you all for being with us today. And I want to welcome our guest today. A guy I go back with a long, long way is Greg Sargent from The New Republic. He has a piece out right now that I think is absolutely outstanding as a view inside the motivations of what Stephen Miller is doing with ICE, DHS, and his powers over the Department of Justice, etc. And it's called Inside Stephen Miller's Dark Plot to Build a MAGA Terror State. And you know, Greg, when I read it, I was like, this is the perfect summation of all the stuff around Miller. There's always so much busyness and noise with DHS and ICE and all the other stuff he's got his paws in. But this really was a distillation of just how grim, how dark his vision of what he wants to accomplish is. Why don't you walk folks through what it is that Stephen Miller's really after in his quest for power?
Well, good to be on, Rick. It's always good to talk to you, man. We do go back a long way. I don't want to tell anyone how long we go back.
There's a 9 in the year, folks. And I mean in the second, the third digit.
Right, exactly. Well, so there are two layers to Miller's dark plot. Like one is ideological and the other is policy. Yeah. So let's just sort of start with policy. I think what people don't really understand is that he isn't merely just trying to enforce the law, as the dumb Republican talking point constantly puts it.
The Democrat Party does not fight for, care about, or represent American citizens. It is an entity devoted exclusively to the defense of hardened criminals, gangbangers, and illegal alien killers and terrorists. The Democrat Party is not a political party. It is a domestic extremist organization. Here in Washington, D.C., before President Trump launched the federal law enforcement liberation in D.C., there is a murder on the streets of this town every other day. Body after body after body after body. That was Washington, D.C. Residents were afraid to go to restaurants. They were afraid to go into entire neighborhoods. They were getting carjacked right and left, robbed and beaten. That was Washington, D.C. Now we're 2 weeks homicide free, the safest this city has ever been in its entire history. And the Democrats, instead of jumping up and down and saying, thank you, President Trump, thank you for saving our lives, thank you for saving our cities, thank you for scrubbing away all the graffiti, the trash, the homeless encampments, the druggies, instead of cleaning up the city, instead of thanking him for that, they're saying, President Trump, how dare you save our lives? How dare you save our children? How dare you save our city? The Democrat Party, Sean, that exists today, it disgusts me. I do not recognize that party, Sean.
He's actually prioritizing, as a policy goal, above every other goal, removing as many immigrants from the country as possible at the expense of public safety. And this is a critical point that I think is lost on a lot of people, right? So they go out there and they say, we're removing illegal alien criminals or whatever, you know, formulation they always use. By the way, have you noticed, Rick, they always add the word criminal to illegal alien.
Yes, always.
And ICE is joining with ATF, DEA, and FBI to carry out the largest deportation operation in American history. The criminals are going home. The border is sealed shut. America is safe, sovereign, proud, and free. We are a nation that everyone in the world understands all across this planet. You do not come here illegally. You will not get in. You will go to jail. You will go home. You will not succeed. Death penalty is back. Law and order is back. The streets are being made safe once again.
Right. And
always.
And that's not like that's not an accident. That is something that came down from on high from Stephen Miller. He has instructed everyone to use the word criminal whenever talking about immigrants. Right. And so the key thing here is that Miller has diverted immense amounts of law enforcement resources and channeled those resources into deportations of people who are not a public safety threat. And he's, in so doing, removed those resources from their focus on serious crimes like child trafficking and drug trafficking, because he views the presence of immigrants in the country as a worse thing than those crimes. This is the thing,
correct?
Right. I mean, this is the core goal of his policy, I think, in every which way, to prioritize ethnic reengineering of the country over public safety.
For more than 9 months into the Trump administration's immigration crackdown, roughly 220,000 people have been arrested by ICE agents. That number comes from new data shared by the University of California, Berkeley, as part of its deportation data project. It also found that nearly 75,000 people who were arrested have no criminal records. These numbers give one of the most revealing looks into the Trump administration's aggressive efforts to rein in immigration. NBC News senior Homeland Security correspondent Julia Ainsley joins us to break down this new data. Julia, good morning. Always great to have you with us. So the University of California got this information. It was through a lawsuit, actually, that it brought against ICE. What else did it reveal about ICE's arrests so far this year?
Yeah, they've been able to get a lot of this information that I stopped posting publicly. Every once in a while, we'll get a press release when they have something they want to tell us about, maybe a high-profile person or someone with a criminal record they have arrested. But in general, it's been really hard to compile this data. So that's why this is important. Of those 75,000, they had no criminal record. But then there were also a third with pending criminal charges. They hadn't been convicted yet. So really, a third of the 220,000 that were arrested between Inauguration Day and mid-October are convicted criminals. And this is despite the promise to go after the worst of the worst.
Yeah, that quote that runs around about Miller is, he'd like to depopulate the country to 100 million people who look like him.
Yes, I believe Trump said that Miller said that to him. And I think Trump has, they've publicly denied that. But there is absolutely no doubt whatsoever that that is his vision in some sense or other. Whether the number is exact, you know, never mind that. He wants to shrink the population to people who are from the right countries. That is just the goal. And it's very hard to get people to tell the story that way, but that is the story.
You know, we live in a very hectic time, very stressful world. You need an escape from that, but you don't always have time to go somewhere, to go on a vacation, to go to somewhere where it's a retreat, somewhere sort of refuge from the noise and the chaos and the stress. So, you know, with Boll & Branch sheets, you can build a relaxing refuge and escape that you don't have to leave home for. And you can make it even better by adding the Boll & Branch waffle bed blanket. With layers and layers of really fine organic cotton, your bed becomes a really comfortable retreat. It's there anytime you need it. Boll & Branch's signature sheets and the waffle bed blanket have become this must-have bedding combination. We have it and love it. The signature sheet set, it's iconic, it's essential, it gets softer over time. That was always the lore of Boll & Branch, is like the sheets get softer every time you wash them. And I thought, how is that possible? But it is. The waffle bed blanket, it gives you this weightless texture. It's just such a nice addition. You know, we're hot sleepers and the sheets are cool, but the waffle bed blanket, if you want to really wrap up in it, it'll keep you as toasty as you want. It's loved by millions of sleepers. It's woven by artisans with the finest 100% organic cotton, the highest levels of craftsmanship. You can add more layers without feeling like heavy or hot. It's made to get softer with every wash, and it does. It's designed to mix and match. They've got over 300 color combinations, and it's yours to try for a 30-night worry-free guarantee. We were Boll & Branch customers before Boll & Branch was a sponsor of this show. And I can tell you, you can feel the difference in quality immediately. They really are a terrific investment compared to any other bedding you've used. It is a step up like you cannot believe. Discover a softness beyond your wildest dreams with Boll & Branch. Get 15% off your first order plus free shipping at bollandbranch.com/Lincoln with code Lincoln. That's Boll & Branch, B-O-L-L-A-N-D, branch.com/Lincoln, code Lincoln to unlock 15% off. Exclusions apply. For those of us who've studied Trump for a long time, the explicit nature of that statement should not come as a surprise to anybody. This is classic Trump. He's a guy who is from Queens. He's got a long history of not exactly being a poster child for racial tolerance.
14,000 apartments in 39 different buildings, all mostly white tenants. That is until the Department of Justice took notice in 1973 and slammed Donald Trump and his father, Fred Trump, with a lawsuit. Trump management was charged with discriminating against African Americans and breaking federal law. Donald Trump, then just 27, was president of the company.
The Department of Justice accused the Trumps of violating the Fair Housing Act, arguing they were turning away renters based on race and color. Who tipped them off? Local activists, so-called testers, posing as potential renters at Trump's buildings, mainly in Brooklyn and Queens.
Elise Goldweber was a lawyer for the DOJ's Fair Housing section at the time and was called on to handle the Trump case.
When the black testers came, they may have been shown apartments, but were told nothing was available. Whereas when the white testers came, yes, there were things that were available. That would be the norm.
And if the Trumps did rent to a black person, Goldweber recalls, they would do so only at one building in Brooklyn, reserving the other buildings for white tenants.
That the white people would live in Trump Village and the people of color would live in Flatbush.
And according to the Justice Department, they even had a secret coding system to do it, a racial code. Here's how.
Some of the applications were marked with a C, which we learned that it meant colored, so that the prospective tenants who had come in were noted to be colored.
Yes, you heard her right. The Department of Justice alleged applications submitted by prospective African-American renters were designated with a secret code, such as C for colored, to indicate a black person was looking to rent.
And all of it with Miller, it always seemed to be such a perfect fit with Miller, who, you know, as you outlined, this is a guy who is, you know, not from the Aryan poster boy club. This is
right.
A guy who comes from a Jewish family in Santa Monica, California, and it just blows my mind even to this day. Like the things that have broken inside this man's soul must be more horrific than we can imagine, because he is truly a broken and dark figure.
Well, we actually talked to his cousin, who doesn't ever give interviews. We were fortunate enough to get an interview with her. People may remember that over the summer, she created a splash because she posted either on Threads or on Facebook. I can't remember exactly where, but she did this post on social media where she essentially flamed the shit out of Stephen Miller and said it's like a catastrophe, you know, for her to be seeing that her own relative is doing all these horrible things. Actually, let me pull the quote up because it's so good.
Hang on,
just bear with me, guys. So this cousin's name is Alyssa Kasmer, and I'm going to read what she said for this piece because it's so good. Quote, "We're Jewish. We grew up knowing how hated we were for just existing. Now he's trying to take away the exact thing that his own family benefited from, that ability to create a life for themselves, to prosper, to build community, to have successful businesses, to live a rewarding life." That's Alyssa Kasmer, who is Stephen Miller's cousin, talking about the fact that Stephen Miller's own ancestors immigrated here at the turn of the 20th century and thrived as a result over time.
Yep. But also Stephen Miller himself, he comes from an immigrant background.
Yeah.
In 2018, his uncle wrote this op-ed saying, "Stephen Miller is an immigration hypocrite. I know because I'm his uncle. If my nephew's ideas on immigration had been enforced a century ago, our family would have been wiped out. He is an American because of immigration, because of chain migration. His family came from what I guess Trump would now call a shithole country or a shithole part of the world, war-torn, fleeing persecution."
His great-great-grandfather was the first to arrive, we were able to establish, and this guy ended up selling bananas on the street. He was a street peddler. And then they became successful over time. And so for Alyssa Kasmer and a few other family members like Stephen Miller's uncle, they look at their own family history and they say, how can this guy who has benefited from the blessings of American life turn around and snatch that away from so many millions of other people?
It is one of those mysteries about Miller. And as somebody, you know, from Republican world, we weren't friends, but I knew Stephen Miller when I was still a Republican. And everybody had that sort of like, he's a weird dude. He's a weird dude. Stephen Miller's a weird dude. But it wasn't until this Trump era where I think he decided Trump was going to be the vector for his hatreds, the tool he would use to finally achieve what he's wanted to achieve here, you know, by his own admission for a long time. And it still to this day kind of shocks me how vivid he lets his hatreds play out in the public eye, just because it's clearly not where America is.
Well, absolutely. We should note that he is from the restrictionist wing of the party, but you're right. Like he had a much lower profile before. I think folks may not know this, but he worked as a senior advisor to Senator Jeff Sessions for a while on the Hill. And he would call reporters and say the stuff that he says now, only in those days, in
it was generally off the record.
Yes, right. And in the context of the Republican Party in those days, it was a bit of an extreme position. Like, well, you know this better than anybody, but the Republican Party was kind of more divided on these questions back in
you had my old boss George H.W. He and Ronald Reagan one time in a primary debate in 1980 got in this pretty heated argument, like which one was going to be better for immigrants coming to America.
Yes, my name is David Grossberg, and I'd like to know, do you think the children of illegal aliens should be allowed to attend Texas public schools free, or do you think that their parents should pay for their education?
Who are you addressing that to?
I think you're first in this.
He was looking right at you.
I said he was.
Look, I'd like to see something done about the illegal alien problem that would be so sensitive and so understanding about labor needs and human needs that problem wouldn't come up. But today, if those people are here, I would reluctantly say I think they would get whatever it is that they're, you know, what the society is giving to their neighbors. But the problem has to be solved. The problem has to be solved because as we have kind of made illegal some kinds of labor that I'd like to see legal, we're doing two things. We're creating a whole society of really honorable, decent, family-loving people that are in violation of the law. And secondly, we're exacerbating relations with Mexico. The answer to your question is much more fundamental than whether they attend Houston schools, it seems to me. I don't want to see a whole, if they're living here, I don't want to see a whole thing of 6 and 8 year old kids being made, you know, one totally uneducated and made to feel that they're living with outside the law. Let's address ourselves to the fundamentals. These are good people, strong people. Part of my family is a Mexican.
Can I add to that? I think the time has come that the United States and our neighbors, particularly our neighbor to the south, should have a better understanding and a better relationship than we've ever had. And I think that we haven't been sensitive enough to our size and our power. They have a problem of 40 to 50% unemployment. Now, this cannot continue without the possibility arising with regard to that other country that we talked about, of Cuba and what it is stirring up, of the possibility of trouble below the border, and we could have a very hostile and strange neighbor on our border. Rather than making them, or talking about putting up a fence, why don't we work out some recognition of our mutual problems, make it possible for them to come here legally with a work permit, and then while they're working and earning here, they pay taxes here. And when they want to go back, they can go back, and they can cross and open the border both ways by understanding their problems. This is the only safety valve right now they have with that unemployment that probably keeps the lid from blowing off down there. And I think we could have a fine relationship, and it would solve the problem you mentioned also.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
And both of them, were very much understanding that immigrants have played a role in this country from our very start. We are, in fact, a nation, the proverbial nation of immigrants. And you know, if you look at George W. Bush, he desperately wanted to get an immigration deal settled. You look at John McCain, Mitt Romney. There was no Stephen Miller coalition inside the GOP at scale. There were handfuls of them. But he, in some ways, sort of built and crafted this anti-immigrant hatred. He found where it was in the base. But between Miller and Murdoch, I think they found something that was politically very powerful and rode with it.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to look at one other element of the history, which is that during the Obama years, the Republican Party still had fairly large chunks of it,
sure,
devoted to reforming the immigration,
sure,
system. So when,
including Marco Rubio.
Well, let's talk about that. So the Marco Rubio, yeah, who's like at the forefront right now of Trump's anti-immigrant, yep, agenda in many ways. He's the, mm-hmm, guy who, as Secretary of State, is like trying to deport immigrants for saying the wrong thing about political issues and so forth, and claiming all these shadowy powers to do that.
Right.
Right. He was actually something of a hero in the 2000s. So people may not.
100%.
Right. In 2013, Barack Obama got the Democratic controlled Senate to pass comprehensive immigration reform, which contained a path to legalization,
right,
for millions of immigrants, undocumented, mm-hmm, and huge amounts of border security. Right. Yeah. And Marco Rubio was out on the forefront of trying to sell this to the base. And he was,
yep,
quite heroic about it. He took a huge amount of abuse,
he did,
and he found clever ways to communicate about this stuff to the base. And, you know, he was close. And John Boehner, who was the speaker in those days, you may recall, mm-hmm, that guy. I wonder how he's doing.
Oh, he's drinking.
Yeah, I would say he probably is, and smoking. So, you know, basically what happened was Obama and he were on the phone and they came very close to getting a vote in the House on this thing. And it would have passed. It would have passed.
Absolutely would have.
And I don't know that we get Trump if that had happened.
No, I don't think we do. In a weird way, I don't think we do. I think it would have been a fait accompli, and it would have been really hard for Trump types to say, oh, this is the center of what the GOP is defined as. This is what this is the defining characteristic of our entire movement and party. And it's interesting because even though as much as they had really gone after Hispanics in the last few years, there was a part of the GOP after the 2024 election, they were like, oh, well, we got back young Hispanic men and we did this and we did that. And there was a brief moment, 5 minutes moment, where they were like, well, what are we going to do about that? Because that's a really interesting development. Well, the decision in the end was to do nothing about it because they didn't want to anger the both the media apparatus and the base of the party by you know, touching that particular third rail of Republican politics. But I mean, I do find it fascinating, Greg, that we have a guy who is essentially in charge of the Department of Homeland Security, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and he's not in charge of it, but he has an outsized role in the DOJ, who is running this now essentially without any kind of adult supervision.
Yes. His power is enormous.
Describe to people like how far that the power of those organizations has sort of been reposed in Miller.
Okay, so let's go through it, right? So you brought up the Department of Homeland Security. Obviously, Kristi Noem is supposed to be the secretary, but Stephen Miller, right. So Stephen Miller, as has been reported, has frequently been on the phone or at least in meetings with senior ICE people across the country, barking orders at them to get those deportation numbers up. Again, I want to stress, he's obsessed with the number of immigrants that he can get taken out of the country. The number is key to him because this is all about shifting demographics, right?
Right.
And so he controls ICE, essentially, which is, you know, that's especially with these billions and billions of additional dollars now being cranked into this thing.
Bigger budget than the Marine Corps.
It's a real paramilitary army that he's got. It's Trump's paramilitary army, and Miller is the general for it, right?
To all ICE officers, you have federal immunity in the conduct of your duties. And anybody who lays a hand on you or tries to stop you or tries to obstruct you is committing a felony. You have immunity to perform your duties, and no one, no city official, no state official, no illegal alien, no leftist agitator or domestic insurrectionist can prevent you from fulfilling your legal obligations and duties. And the Department of Justice has made clear that if officials cross that line into obstruction, into criminal conspiracy against the United States or against ICE officers, then they will face justice.
But also, Miller has long taken a very keen interest in things like refugee policy. During the first term, he actually killed a report that found that refugees confer economic benefits on the country. He just had it buried. Because it found that refugees are good for the country, so he couldn't allow that.
Yeah.
Right. So and now, right, he's at the forefront of this enormous reduction in the number of refugees we're taking in now, which is like down to in the thousands from around 100,000 under Biden, which is, you know, a huge humanitarian retreat.
Oh, for
sure. But he's the guy who is, I think, directing this prioritization of white South Africans.
A group of white South Africans are now in the U.S. after being granted expedited refugee status. The Trump administration has accused South Africa's black majority government of violence and discrimination against Afrikaners, the white majority that ruled South Africa during apartheid. South African officials have denied those claims. Scott, what do we know about the president expediting the resettlement of these South Africans but halting other refugee admissions?
That really is the controversy, Vlad. These 59 people we saw ushered into Dulles International Airport in Virginia yesterday were expedited. They were fast-tracked into the U.S., claiming refugee status, seeking resettlement, even as the administration kind of closes the valve on the resettlement of others from other war-torn places or other harrowing circumstances. It was really quite a sight to watch them come in. We saw the children come out first, saw the parents behind them being greeted by Trump administration officials with balloons and flags. The issue here, according to the Deputy Secretary of State, who we pressed for answers, is that there are, quote, harrowing circumstances and the threat of death or killing for these refugees back home in South Africa. The administration is going to be facing criticism from start to finish on this because these were white faces inside the airport hangar as so many people from other countries unsuccessfully seek that same treatment.
Which is, you know, this is
mind-blowing.
It's
frankly,
the shamelessness of this is staggering. They invent the idea of a white genocide supposedly happening mm-hmm. to South African white farmers, right? And then they say openly yep. and explicitly, we are prioritizing them over everyone else. And
right.
right, so Trump is out there saying, we will not take anyone from the third world. And we know what that means, right? Africa and Latin
yes.
American countries, we won't take them anymore.
Brown.
Brown. And we will take white South Africans because they're the real victims right now in globally. Mm-hmm. They're the real victims of human rights abuses that we should care about. It's just so disgusting. Again, he's actively making the selection of whites a preference in resettling refugees.
I mean, I think that it's interesting because even in places where he wasn't the one who pulled the trigger, that mindset that he has sort of imbued this administration with, like killing USAID. That was from what I was told from people inside, it was very much an Elon Musk thing, again, related to South Africa, but that Marco was fine pulling the trigger on it. Didn't care. Wasn't a big deal for him. He wanted to keep Elon happy. They were going to be friends. But that it reflects, I think, the Miller, you know, for lack of a better word, the vibe that Miller wants in this administration, the feeling of, you know, we're going to do these things that seem contrary to the past and contrary to our values, but we're going to impose a new set of values and a new set of rules in this country.
Yeah, I mean, it all comes down to what do we do about the global poor? What sort of obligations do we recognize
right.
for them? And for MAGA, they delight sadistically in the idea of cutting the global poor loose entirely. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of the through line, right?
No, our old buddy Adam Serwer, the cruelty is the point.
Exactly. Adam Serwer nailed it very early on, and now we're really seeing
yep.
it implemented in a new kind of supercharged way compared to Trump
right.
1.0.
Right.
Right. So the through line is, right, cutting loose the global poor. So no more refugees from poor countries in Africa or Latin America. And no more aid to dying
right.
kids. And
right, we're gonna starve kids to show how hardcore we are.
Exactly. Elon Musk's famous quote about the empathy gene being like the weakness of Western civilization.
The fatal to humanity is the empathy gene. Okay.
The fundamental weakness of Western civilization is empathy. The empathy exploit. They're exploiting a bug in Western civilization, which is the empathy response.
Right. What he means is we got to really cut loose the global poor, guys.
You
know, what's killing us here is our sense of obligation to
decency,
which, by the way,
and humanity.
Is really,
yeah.
Right. It's really minimal to begin with. Like, that's the thing about it, right?
This has
like,
always been something that you know, and even when I was a Republican, I had to correct my fellow Republicans, like, guys, foreign aid and refugee aid is rounding error on the bottom possible smallest line
exactly.
of the budgets. It is we spend vastly more money on a billion other things, and helping refugees is traditionally been viewed correctly, I think, as a soft power element that is cheap at twice the price.
Yeah, we get a huge payback for this.
Huge.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I think there was, during the cuts to USAID, that whole debate, there was this whole thing about how these peanut butter pouches that get sent to the very poorest of the poor. These are kids who are on the brink of starvation. They can't eat normal food. They're in a very terrible place, obviously, humanitarian wise. And so American companies manufacture these little peanut butter packets. And I believe there's one brand of it that says something like brought to you by courtesy of
the people of the United States of America.
Yep. That's it. Right. And that's key, mm-hmm. right? Like the people of the United States are looking out for you out there. Right. And by the way, these are things that are grown in Georgia, right? The peanuts are grown in Georgia.
So much of these USAID cuts were for food contracts with farmers in very red parts of the country. And I've told this story recently, but I've gotten to know a guy who is a very hardcore Trump supporter. He can't believe that he's going to lose his farm because his largest contract was USAID. And he sold every year to USAID a vast amount of soybeans and peanuts to help feed kids in conditions of absolute privation and horror. But now,
I mean,
that's gone because right? that would be sending a signal to the wrong kind of pores.
Right, exactly. Like, what's better for the United States than for American bounty, you know, the American land? These lunatics love talking about the homeland, right? And showing, like, I don't know if how closely you follow the Department of Homeland Security's
Twitter
feed. Oh,
I do. I'm afraid I do.
It is a white nationalist sewer pit,
yeah.
man.
Oh, completely. And you know, I had somebody inside the Republican world like, oh, they're just trolling. I'm like, no. That's not trolling.
Exactly.
Trolling has a style and a purpose that's different than posting the Aryan master race images and memes every day of the week. Yeah, it's a different animal.
Yeah, and so yeah, they often sort of show these idealized shots of the homeland, yep. where people riding through and horses
sure.
or whatever,
right.
you know, the manly men, the Aryan on top of his steed
right.
or whatever.
Right.
These are, I guess, they're descendants from Vikings or something.
Who knows?
Is that the basic implication?
There's some weird vibe in their brains of that they think they're getting, but I can't quite put my finger on it.
Well, it's overly, it's super sexualized, right?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Like,
well, there's that too.
Christy Gnome posing in front of the prisons full of brown tattooed
yeah.
people.
Yeah. There is
some sick.
There's
shit,
a lot.
Man.
Yeah. There's a lot to the way they portray their role as enforcers or enforcers and protectors of white virtue. That is,
oh, yes.
Well beyond,
right.
I mean, well beyond parody. It is, they're not kidding about it, folks. They really believe this.
Oh, yeah. And I think you just put your finger on it because you, having been inside that beast for a long
yep.
time, the Republican message beast and so forth, you know, during periods that were different from this one, but also, you know, pretty rough.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Like rough political fighting. You know, you have a feel, I think. You've always had an instinct for the way Republican communications go for the gut.
Yeah. It's always right? about the gut and the heart, not about some intellectualized process of, of policy discussion. They want to get you hating or angry or brutalize or being willing to brutalize somebody who is different. That is the fundamental of it. And they've gotten very good at it. I mean, I think as technology has improved, unfortunately, they've become very skillful.
Yes, very skillful
at turning turning racial and ethnic resentment into very powerful political weapons. It doesn't always hold up over time, but it we can't pretend it doesn't exist because it absolutely is like the defining political tactic of the day now.
I'll tell you a story, Rick. There are some Democratic strategists get this about Republican communications. Mm-hmm. I was communicating, the Obama people understood this because they were doing their own for the gut and heart communications,
sure.
Right? They had their own story that they were telling about Barack Obama, which was, you know, he is, I think, probably the most charismatic and skilled politician of time.
No question.
But I think Donald Trump is the second most charismatic and skilled politician of our time in his own really twisted
you
way.
You have to acknowledge, and I've said this to a lot of Democrats who don't want to think about it a lot of the time. If you don't acknowledge that he has massive skills at persuasion, you will always go, what's happening? Why do people believe that? He has those things. You can't deny it. And it doesn't make him a good person. It makes him more dangerous, not less. But it is 100%. Definitely they have leveraged that skill set, as a political tool, I think more than Obama was ever able to outside of his own sort of inner circle.
Right. They were, the Obama people were on the cutting edge of the internet as it was in those days.
Yeah.
And Trump's people are on the cutting edge of what it is now. So this Democratic strategist, you'll love this one, Rick. I was talking to this. He was a guy who worked for the Obama White House, and we were arguing about something about Dem messaging. And at one point, he just exploded to me, and he said, "This is not a fucking debate at the Brookings Institution."
Bingo. That
right?
is it. It is not a debate
never
at the Brookings Institution. None of this. For all that our Democratic friends love policy, it's never about policy these days. It is about emotion. And I think that is something, I mean, to give him, to acknowledge it, that Stephen Miller gets that, is like saying Trump's a good communicator. It happens to be true. Stephen Miller gets that there's a part of American culture and society that is scared to death of brown people. He gets that. He is not stupid about that. He is not, and it's not just the racism. It's the racism, but it's not just the racism. It's also the political opportunism.
Right. He's a shrewd operator for sure.
People should underestimate his bureaucratic and political skill set.
Absolutely. And there's Stephen Miller, just to go back to the piece a little bit, Stephen Miller is a bit of a puzzle in another sense, though. He clearly has his finger on that element of American culture, but he's such an ideologue. He's so hopelessly devoted to this white nationalist project that he doesn't seem aware of the backlash to it. What do you think, Rick?
I think that's right. I mean, I think he has, there are a lot of folks around Trump who have been convinced since 2015, 16, that if we have the base, we have everything we need. If we have the MAGA base and they're happy, we have everything we need. Now, I don't think that is real. I think that the MAGA base is definitely no longer sufficient. I don't think it's ever been fully sufficient, but I know it's not sufficient now. But he has been raised inside this bubble. And for all that Republicans like to project, like, oh, liberals live inside a media bubble where they're always told what they want to hear, that is vastly more true of the right wing now than it's ever been of the left. The right wing media bubble is a snake that eats its own tail. It's always saying, we're owning the libs, we're winning, everything is great, nothing is wrong, all the things we've said are true. Anybody who denies it is a deep state liberal Marxist communist, whatever. And I think Miller has lived in that bubble a bit too long and a bit too comfortably, because he is falling prey to the same kind of sort of mental blinders that got a lot of Democrats in trouble after Obama.
Yes, I think that's, you know, exactly
the
right.
The sort of feeling of, okay, the world has changed. We've had a black president who ran a moderately progressive administration. So therefore, nothing will ever change. It will never go back. And it went back. And I think they were shocked by it.
It went back and then
went way back. But I think Miller is going to have that same experience. There's going to come an ugly day where they realize that what they're doing isn't just unpopular, it's disqualifying. And, you know,
I sure hope you're right, man. I will say it's very heartening right now what we're seeing in cities across the country.
Oh, for sure.
The outpouring of support and the outpouring of vigilance,
yes,
community vigilance towards these ICE goons, these masked stormtroopers that they're sending in to kidnap people.
Hey, no fear! Immigrants are welcome here! No hate, no fear! Immigrants are welcome here!
It's so important that we use our collective voices to fight the good fight, to organize, to make sure that our voices are being heard and that our freedoms and rights are being fought for.
I call your congresswoman, here she is! Let me tell you how proud I am of Milwaukee coming out. West Allis, I represent Milwaukee and West Allis.
Yes.
Coming out to stand up. This is the only thing that works, y'all, pushing back. Democracy is the only thing that is the antiseptic against autocracy. And just let me just say this. What they are doing is unconstitutional and unlawful. Yeah. It is illegal. And I will tell you that I sat next to now Attorney General Keith Ellison for 14 years, and I can tell you the statute of limitations will not run out on the lives of our ICU nurse, latest victim, Anora Renee Good, and they will be prosecuted.
Yes,
cannot pardon them for the egregious sins that they have pushed onto the Minnesotan people, the people in the Twin Cities. His pardon will not excuse them. And in the meantime, you know, the people united can never be defeated.
That's an extraordinary development.
Truly.
And as far, and you may be able to tell me whether I'm right about this, but it looks to me like it's simply not registering on the MAGA radar. What's going on?
I don't think it is. I think they live in the Fox bubble, where it's always heroic ICE officer battles illegal immigrant, child smuggler, drug toting terrorist, whatever. They're always hearing that song played in one yes. pitch, right?
They don't understand that majorities see ICE as a malicious and threatening presence.
Correct. And that's what they don't understand. ICE made the mistake from the very beginning of this process. They made a huge mistake. The going in masked, the whole, you know, everything requires a SWAT team. Let's zip tie these children because God knows if they're going to attack us or not. All that garbage, all that drama that was good pictures for Fox and good video for people like Stephen Miller. Everyone else in the country looks at it and goes, what is happening here? Why is this happening? And they don't like it. And again, they've lost they lost one of their superpowers. They forgot that those videos would hit people in the heart and the gut. And they've been hitting them in a way where vast numbers of people now disapprove of ICE and DHS.
ICE, DHS, Kristi Noem have been a political disaster, because just take a look here. I mean, ICE's net approval rating during Trump's terms, you go back to term number one, look, it's pretty even, 0 points. You go to June 2025, right? That was when all that stuff was going on in Los Angeles. They dropped down, look at this, minus 17 points, way in the basement. But then after Minneapolis, It's even lower, minus 27 points on the net approval rating of ICE. Of course, this all being done under Kristi Noem. So, no, what's going on in Minneapolis is not popular at all. What's been going on during this second term under ICE, under the Trump administration, under Kristi Noem, has very much not been popular, and it's only been getting more and more unpopular.
Trump is now underwater on the topic of immigration, which was always one of his very best issues for years.
And that is a huge thing.
That's a big deal.
Because it means that voters are paying attention to the difference between what's going on in the interior of the country and what's going on at the border.
Right.
And they're saying, look, okay, we elected you to secure the border or whatever. We thought it was a disaster under Biden. Fine, I can accept that, right? But we did not elect you to remove people who have been part of our communities for, you know, years, who have jobs here, who have contributed,
who have associated families
with our people.
I mean, one of the things that I think was one of the biggest evidentiary points on this, Greg, in Miami, we see a Democrat elected mayor of Miami, Florida. And one of the things that was a underreported factor in that is all those Cubans and all those Venezuelans who live in that community, 350,000 people in that community have been taken off of protected status by ICE and Miller.
She made an issue of
that. And wanted to make it a big deal. And suddenly, even these conservative Cubans are like, wait, you're not going to deport my nephew. You're not going to deport my niece. You're not going to deport my abuela. What's going on here? And they were so angry about it. And, you know, you've even got the Republican congresswoman down there, Salazar, now freaking out because she's like, no, we're not going to deport any of these people. I'm like, oh, well, ask Kristi Noem and Stephen Miller because they have a different opinion. But it's starting to leak into the politics now, and they don't know what to do with it.
Right. It's a real bad spot for Republicans, I think, because, again, to go back to what you were pointing out before, which is the degree to which Trump and Stephen Miller are operating in this bubble, they're not able to conceive of this as unpopular.
Right. That's right. They right? can't. And even if they do, Miller would think this less than Trump because Trump has a keen sense of the base. Even if they were to step out of it, Trump is not going to lose more parts of his base. He's lost parts of his base over Epstein, over the economy. And I don't think he wants to lose more of it. I don't think he can afford to lose more of it and keep his coalition intact. So, you know, that's why even if Trump knew it was wrong, and knew it was hurting him, he's not going to back off on it.
Well, I'll tell you what, I thought it was really interesting when he went out there and he said on Twitter that farmers were losing good workers because of the deportations. Yep. It's like that is a direct repudiation
That's on
of
you,
everything
Don.
MAGA stands for. Yeah, right. And so he went out there and he argued with MAGA a bit more on the question of the South Korean workers in the Georgia plant. I forget what the plant is.
Hyundai.
What is that plant? Right, Hyundai. Right. And so he's trying to talk to people like Stephen Miller, I think, with this stuff and saying, you know, we can't remove the people we actually need. This right. And so I think Trump is kind of conflicted. He's drawn to the ethno-nationalist ideological impulse, right? In the sense that he's out there saying we're not going to take anyone from shithole countries, by which he means, you know, brown people, as you said. He's out there saying we won't take anyone from the third world. So please bring me some more Nordic whites.
Why is it we only take people from shithole countries, right? Why can't we have some people from Norway, Sweden, just a few? Let us have a few. We always take people from Somalia, places that are a disaster, right? Filthy, dirty, disgusting, ridden with crime.
He's in that ideological space in some ways, in the sense that he does want to remake the country ethnically and demographically, but then not if it really creates problems.
Yeah, right. That. How far up the line do you take it is the question.
So, right.
Well, Greg Sargent, I appreciate you coming on the show today, my friend. It was great talking to you as always, and we will have you back real soon, folks. You can catch Greg on their excellent podcast at New Republic, The Daily Blast. It is terrific. You should listen to it. Greg, where else can folks find you on socials?
Well, we are on Twitter at Greg T. Sargent and on Blue Sky as well, same. And people can find my stuff at tnr.com or newrepublic.com and at the Daily Blast podcast, which is a daily pod, believe it or not. It comes out every day, five
Better
days
you
a
than
week.
Me, brother.
You can find that. It's a lot of work, but it's great fun, man. You know how it is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Greg, thanks again. We'll see you again next time.
Good to talk to you, Rick.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I'm delighted to be joined today by a guy who I respect a lot. He is a guy from the old neighborhood in Tallahassee for a little while, and a guy who came up in Gainesville, Florida, and he has and rose to be the head of FEMA. And despite what a lot of folks on the other side of the fence are telling you right now, FEMA is an extraordinarily important function in our government, extraordinarily positive outcomes during natural disasters. I want to welcome Craig Fugate to the show. Craig, thank you for joining us today. And I want to launch right into this. Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem made two statements in the White House, in the Oval Office, that I found shocking. She goes, "We're going to have two or three storms this year," which, if I was a betting man, I would never make that bet. And that we're going to, and that FEMA is a failure, and that it hasn't helped Americans. It's failed over and over again.
We all know from the past that FEMA has failed thousands, if not millions, of people. And President Trump does not want to see that continue into the future. So this agency fundamentally needs to go away as it exists.
Despite the fact that no government agency is perfect, I'm delighted to be joined today by you because you know FEMA better than almost any human being alive. And I'm curious what you thought about her statements. And then I want to launch into like why we need FEMA in this country right now.
Well, you know, they say a lot of things in Washington. I usually wait to see what happens. And it's interesting, it's going to be states' responsibilities. That wasn't how the public viewed it after Hurricane Katrina, and it wasn't how the public viewed it after Hurricane Andrew. And in both cases, it was administrations that got drugged down by those responses.
Oh, yes, they did.
So, again, I listened to it, but I've asked rhetorical questions like that before. I was at the Florida Chamber, and I brought up the issue. I said, what would Florida look like after Hurricane Andrew if the federal government, meaning the federal taxpayer, wasn't there to bail us out?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a moment in that post-Andrew thing. I was working for the Defense Department. We flew down. The Secretary of the Air Force, some other folks flew down to see what had happened at Homestead throughout Miami. And I'm a fifth-generation Floridian. I thought I've seen hurricane stuff. I couldn't believe the scope of it, but I also couldn't believe the scope of what FEMA was able to throw at the problem almost immediately. This idea you're going to push it out to the states, to my mind, is a really strange one because there are capacities FEMA has that the states can't organically maintain individually. What happens when there's a major disaster and FEMA rolls in? Because as Florida men, you know, we seem to be a little more on the reality side of the curve here. I'm curious explain to people what happens. It's not some random government, bureaucracy.
No, I mean, the most immediate thing that FEMA does is join up with their state counterparts in the State Emergency Operations Center. That's one of the things about FEMA. We go to where the need is. We don't sit in Washington and make everybody find us. We'll send in, and this is still current, but we'll send teams in, and I did it. The Trump administration one did it. The Biden administration does it. And I assume they're going to continue to do it. They're going to send teams into those state EOCs when it's either evident that a disaster of that magnitude occurred or when the governor has requested assistance. And probably the most immediate things FEMA does is coordinate on behalf of the president federal resources. Part of that's the urban search and rescue teams that FEMA sponsors to send those in, communications that FEMA has, emergency supplies, the Army Corps of Engineers, emergency generators, if necessary, disaster medical assistance teams, DOD assets to support National Guard. So that first focus is always on life-saving and life-sustaining operations. It isn't about the money. It's about what does a state need that it does not have access to that the federal government can coordinate and get there in time. There's actually a middle ground that I support, and that is I think we have biased so much to FEMA coming in so early that a lot of states haven't taken on the responsibility of responding to
it.
But I also think it's important that FEMA has to be ready to go and maintain that partnership with states. So when it does get to the level appropriate for your federal tax dollars to support that response, it's ready to go. This isn't something you can leave on the shelf and only break the glass in case of catastrophic disaster. It's got to be something we're doing all the time, or we're just not going to be able to execute it.
Right. I mean, the classic emergency operations paradigm is that you're always training for it. You're always ready for it. You're always ready, as you said, the breaking glass moment. FEMA's budget is what is FEMA's budget? I honestly have no idea. Like, what's the ballpark on what FEMA spends every year?
Well, there's two parts to FEMA's budget. It's the budget to keep the organization running and its reoccurring cost and running all its programs. That's a little over $1 billion. That includes a lot of grant programs, staffing. And then you have the disaster funding. We call it Disaster Relief Fund, or DRF. That can be, you know, tens of billions of dollars depending upon the activity of the disasters and how fast they're spending the money in the recovery process. So, the one that gets most people's attention, and to a certain degree, what most of the discussion about is actually in those disaster relief funds, which are primarily recovery dollars that get spent rebuilding and other things. And the other thing that people don't understand, you do realize that only pays for uninsured losses.
Right, right. So, I think that a lot of people think that FEMA just comes in and writes checks to everyone no matter what, but it is only that vulnerable side of the population.
Right. When Tom Ridge wrote this, when he was in the House of Representatives, he had dealt with floods in Pennsylvania, and he saw how fragmented the federal government was. So he was one of the authors of the Stafford Act. And his goal was, it was based upon an insurance model. Most people would be insured. Most governments would be insured. Mm-hmm. The primary thing was, for the federal taxpayer, we'd be a safety net. It's actually changed insurance models breaking down, but also government became self-insured back in the 70s and 80s. And so when you think about all the money we spend in disaster response, some of it makes sense, picking up debris, emergency response costs, running shelters, evacuations. But every time a fire station gets destroyed that is self-insured in a declared disaster, you, the taxpayer, federal taxpayer, will pay 75% of the minimum to rebuild that fire because they didn't have insurance.
So what are the lessons that you took away from your time in emergency management, starting in Alachua County, moving up to FEMA, and now as somebody who consults and talks about and counsels people on how to prepare for things like this? What's the biggest lesson you've taken away from this? Because I do think there needs to be some individual resilience out there. You know, as a vestigial conservative, I believe in being prepared. And I don't know that everybody does. What's the most important thing you would have people take away from the lessons you've learned as an emergency management guy over the years?
Learn about things that can go wrong in your community and prepare to your best of your ability. And the other thing, and this is something that doesn't get a lot of attention, in a disaster, once you and your family are safe, check on your neighbors. It's the fastest response. We'll save more lives. I mean, this is just basic. I've seen this all the way from rural parts of my state where, you know, the first response was a farmer and a tractor going out during an ice storm to help get to a warm place. So I think we sometimes focus so much on government, we forget, hey, we've got a lot of people out there that are going to help. We got a lot of volunteer agencies that are going to help. We got a lot of businesses that are going to help. And government is just part of that team.
Right, right. The idea that we need FEMA to do every single thing is wrong. But so is, I think, the idea that we shouldn't have any kind of federal response to these disasters, just because as you were talking about, how the administrator of FEMA can coordinate all these resources from across the spectrum of government, it to my mind is really like an underscored importance on this in this discussion, because if we don't have the ability to bring in things like National Guard resources and other government resources, you know, we end up sort of fumbling around trying to build this thing afresh every single time.
Yeah, I mean, governors have a lot of ability to manage, I think, a lot of the smaller, medium-sized disasters. You know, the governor can activate National Guard. One of the legacies of the late Governor Childs after Hurricane Andrew was ocean, what became the state mutual aid agreements, what we call the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, where states control resources. In fact, Florida, under Governor Bush, we sent over 6,000 responders to Mississippi during Katrina.
I remember that.
There's a lot of powerful tools there, but you get to the point. As the late Senator Coburn said of Oklahoma, he said, you know, Craig, my state asked for a lot of disasters. I think they should be handling themselves. But we were standing on the ground of the tornado outbreak in Moore, Oklahoma. And it was And he said, and this is where FEMA needs to be there, ready to go. So even Senator Coburn, who was often known as Dr. No.
Yes, he was.
He supported FEMA. He also felt the thresholds were so low, we were discouraging states and local governments from taking on their primary responsibility to their citizens in their time of need and using the federal government when it exceeds that capability, rather than being just a mere speed bump. And then FEMA was expected to carry that work. And again, every time you say FEMA, think about it. It's your tax dollars. It's the federal taxpayer that pays for all this.
I think Americans are a generous people as a rule when they see people suffering. When they see a natural disaster, wildfires, et cetera, I think Americans are profoundly good people. Just after Katrina, a couple of doctors that I know were flying aid into Slidell. They're flying other doctors actually into Slidell, and they're in their own private planes. And one of the guys, you would think this guy was just the most arrogant neurosurgeon type in the world, and yet he was moved by the fact that was a city underwater. Those people were suffering tremendously. And it's like, people do tend to be good in America. They do tend to sort of all hands on deck when we have a disaster like that. One of the questions I wanted to ask you is, we're seeing a lot of shrinkage and cuts in NOAA, which is sort of the early warning system for a lot of what FEMA and state emergency managers have to do.
A lot of the weather forecast offices now are not operating at full complement of staff, which means that you're really putting an extra burden on these folks without research, without staff to do the work. We can assume that the predictions, and not just hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, drought, wildfires, tsunamis, for that matter, are undoubtedly going to degrade. And that means that people's ability to prepare for these storms will be compromised. Pick your favorite football team. Now imagine that team has, instead of 11 players, has 8 players. They're going to lose. No matter how good they are, they can't do the job of the full team. And that's what's happening at NOAA, is these are outstanding scientists, wonderful technicians, terrific policy folks, but if we don't have enough of them doing the job, then something falls off the table.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Talk to me about where you see that. I mean, the folks down in Miami, the weathermen down in Miami, who in Floridians, we've all seen them over 40 years, says I'm not going to be able to predict these things as well. We're starting to lose the data. We're starting to lose the capacity. Talk to us about why those cuts are kind of a danger to emergency preparedness.
Well, the big thing is the data that goes into the models. Our models have gotten very good. There's a lot of debate about our models, European models. Well, guess what? They all need the same data that's originating from observations. And it is those observations that provide the model's ability to do the extremely accurate forecast. So the question, which we don't have answers to, as they have reduced what they call the radiosondes, when they send the balloons up and they've cut them once a day, is that affecting models? What is the requirement for steady state, low intensity weather observations versus during severe weather events? And do they have the right balance? The question I think is, that's a hard one to say yes or no to. I'm more concerned about the loss of experience, which we know pays big dividends in looking at complex weather systems.
Sure.
And now we're losing that. So I'm not seeing forecasts that are yet saying, well, they're not as good, but there's a lot of question as to if we see that, how much of it am I going to have? And like people are saying, we're going to get to the point where we're very reliant upon the model. What happens now if the models are less accurate and now we have that data?
Right. I think people have gotten accustomed to looking at an app on their phone and seeing a hurricane track and saying, oh, it's definitely going in this 30-mile window. But if that becomes a 100-mile window or a 200-mile window, I think that makes it a lot more problematic, a lot more dangerous for people.
Well, Rick, I've been in this business long enough to know that we were back to a 72-hour forecast, and that was the extent of it. And the average error was plus or minus 300 miles. Right. So, you know, we were having to evacuate large sections of Florida for hurricanes. We've got much better forecasts, 5 days out, much narrower areas to evacuate, more forecast on impact. So we've made a lot of improvements. The question will be, do we go backwards? And we may not know that until they go back and like the Hurricane Center every year, they go back and do a reanalysis and look at their forecast accuracy versus actual track. Now, up until this year, they've shown steady progress and improvements. Mm-hmm. So the question will be next year, are we plateauing or are we going backwards? And we may not know that on each individual storm.
Yeah, I think some of the work that gets done in the crisis moments for NOAA, the hurricane hunters, that last minute stuff, that's the real life or death question. I mean, some of it's quality of life, but that's where it gets life or death. And I think that it's just one of these areas where if you kick the FEMA leg out from underneath national disaster preparedness and you kick the NOAA leg out from underneath it, what do you got left? I don't know how you function as a, I mean, and some natural disasters aren't predicted by the weather. They're earthquakes or wildfires or what have you. Well, wildfires, I guess, somewhat by the weather, but it just strikes me that it's penny wise and pound foolish to give up the eyes and ears of tracking major storms.
Well, and just look at the Midwest is just getting repeatedly bracketed this weather outbreaks. And again, this is one of my concerns is when you start going after science because it doesn't fit your narrative, and they're saying we're going to get rid of anything related to climate science. Part of that research is looking at things like the drought cycles, which are a main underlying factor for wildfires. And Rick, you remember back, you know, Florida, everybody says, you know, it's a West Coast thing. I'm like, well, I beg to differ.
Oh, no.
I can remember with Lake Governor Childs, we were burning down so much of the state. We had, of 67 counties, 50 had uncontrolled wildfires, and it was due to 50-year drought.
All through Central Florida and all over North Florida, folks. There was I can't remember the year it was, but it was the year where the sun was orange every day.
The 1998 Florida firestorm was on everyone's memory when we start thinking about all these fires that we've been having all across Central Florida. I spoke with someone who had to be evacuated in 98 and a firefighter who fought during the Florida firestorm. And they all remember all too well how real and how surreal it felt when we saw those flames. A lot of people were just afraid that they would have no home to return to.
The Florida firestorm of 1998 destroyed homes, evacuated an entire county, and left painful memories behind.
When you wake up in the morning and you read that, that's when you got to start praying.
All of Flagler County was actually evacuated, the only county in state history to ever fully be 100% evacuated.
The firestorm forced thousands out of their homes. Ed Corcoran was one of them.
You could see flames from the roof of the house, and ashes were falling on the driveway. Take the leaf blower and blow them away.
The fire line itself was a little over a mile long and 3/4 of a mile deep, moving at 35 miles an hour.
Destroying homes in its path.
On the very first day, there was 140 of them lost in the Seminole Woods area. After that, I lost count of them. When Seminole Woods burnt, I actually graduated fire school and came up here and fought fires all night long.
Flames and smoke lasting for days.
The fires were getting so intense, they were creating their own firestorms. They were creating mini tornadoes in fires. Yeah.
For weeks on end. I mean, it was crazy.
It was 1998, because it was my first 98. Year with the state. But climate research actually is supporting things like looking at these drought cycles.
Sure.
And so when we start taking that science away, it's not just climate. It's a lot of these longer trend weather impacts that we're planning for. I mean, just ask the South Florida Water Management District with Lake Okeechobee and all the factors they do when they go into the dry season and then go into, you know, hurricane season of managing those water supplies based upon these longer range forecasts.
I do think that the like hatred of climate science and the sort of politicized, like, it says climate, we're not touching it idea has become, I mean, look, everybody can talk all day long about the broader amount of carbon in the atmosphere, all that stuff, but it is having legitimate impacts in our climate. Things are changing in our climate. And if we ignore that, I think it is, again, it's one of those things where you win the political battle that day, but you lose the longer term battle of does Miami stay above water?
We're seeing these intense heat waves that are increasing in the average temperature. And this is the thing I keep trying to tell everybody, and we're in a period of adaptation. None of our infrastructure and most of our response coping mechanisms weren't built for these extreme events. And so we're seeing everything from the insurance industry having to walk away. You know, it started in Florida, but now we're seeing it for wildfires and other things where the insurance industry says we can no longer, you know, write this risk at rates people will be willing to pay or states mm-hmm. will write.
In South Florida right now, I know people who are paying as much in property insurance as they are for their mortgage in Dade County. Now, granted, on the water, but still, that market has gone completely sideways. And it is something that, you know, if we're not planning ahead, the long term disasters, not the short acute ones, but those long term things, Florida is a mess in 100 different ways, but that's one of the ones where if we're going to mitigate sea level rise and climate change in South Florida, we had to start 20 years ago, and no one's willing to do it. It seems absolutely like we're stuck. And can't get out of our own way down there.
And much of this is neat. We need to be investing for what the future risk is, not what's happened before. Because I always marvel every time we have a record-setting event. Everybody treats us like, well, this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And I'm like, yeah, but we had a record-setting event, you know, 3 weeks ago.
Right.
It's right. Not something we built for. Our investments need to be really based upon, you know, don't build it just back the way it was, which is, I think, one of our most common problems in recovery.
Absolutely. It's as simple as stuff like localities that have a massive storm event, and they think, well, we're just going to keep our regular drainage and sewage plan in place, and because what could go wrong? It won't happen again. And then it happens again a year later, or 2 years later, or 5 years later. Florida could be largely uninhabitable if we're not careful. And I think to coastal Mississippi, coastal Alabama, Louisiana, coastal Texas, they're all in the same boat with the combination of the long-term climate-induced change and the acute storm damage that we seem to be, you know, a magnet for.
Yeah, I'm not sure we won't be, you know, we won't be able to live here. I just don't think we're going to be able to, a lot of folks, be able to afford to live here.
Yeah. Yeah, that the affordability thing is insane. I live in Tallahassee at about, I don't know, close to 200 feet above sea level, and my flood insurance goes crazy every year. It's happening every, and I, this is not anecdotal. This is everyone I know is seeing that number go up and up and up. And, you know, we don't have the CAT fund, the catastrophic fund anymore in Florida. And the property insurance folks have been able to lobby their way into very high rates and no accountability. So it's it really is a, I look at Florida always as like the leading edge experiment in how America responds to lots of things, whether it's an aging population or climate or natural disasters. We're always the sort of laboratory of that. And then you came up through this, you know, Florida's a hard school for emergency managers.
Yeah, I mean, Andrew broke the system, and I we owe a lot to the late Governor Childs, and we owe a lot to Governor.
Sure do.
Because, you know, the late Governor Childs did not take the approach of firing somebody who said, I fixed a problem. He actually formed what was then called the Lewis Commission with Senator Phil Lewis, a Republican, to see and bring in a lot of experts, local folks, local officials. They came up with 99 recommendations. Not all of them actually got implemented. Some of them were outdated by the time we got to them. But it provided that framework, and Governor Bush pretty much took that and implement it. The other thing that Governor Bush's legacy is, although he likes to be known for cutting red tape, he actually signed into law the statewide unified building code, because he saw that without strong building codes, without good, we were vulnerable and would rapidly become even more uninsurable than we were.
And man, that was a Tallahassee battle royale on that. People did not like that, but he was right to do it. And he was, and Jeb was a good emergency management governor. He was a good leader in crisis. You know, people like, oh, he's the education guy, but I was like, Jeb was out there with the rain gear on. You know?
He stayed out at the EOC during these major storms. He went in the field. It was a great experience to work with him. And I can remember with his brother, the president, we were down at Ponte Gorda after Hurricane Charlie. And we were walking around neighborhoods that were built back in the 70s and 80s, and they were trashed. We get this one house road, and it looked like it was built after the hurricane. This was like 3 days later, and the president looks at his brother and says, what gives? And the governor turned to his brother and said, building codes. That's how dramatic it was.
It has changed. The roofs stay on now, people. They don't fly off like they used to. So Craig, before we wrap up, is there anything that people absolutely need to know when they're thinking about this moment that we're coming into in the emergency season across the country?
You need to know if you live in an evacuation zone, and if you do, your plan is to evacuate and take your pets.
Take your pets, people. All right, Craig, thanks again. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, thank you.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.